blown away by your experiences and what you decided that you felt like you could share. And actually, quite so many of you are very, very courageous and have been through a lot and very strong. So just before I get going on the different pieces of the logistics of the paper, the way I broke it down, since there were 25 points, there were about 12 criteria, and so you were given about 2 points for each criteria. If I didn't see any notice of them in your paper, it was 2 points off for each one. And then the ability that you could explain it, you were given another point. And everybody did really well of at least acknowledging each part of the paper. And I put things along the side if something wasn't acknowledged, putting like a question mark, did you consider your developmental status? I'd like to see you expand a little bit more on saying, if you gave an example for a hypothesis, how it fits into that hypothesis. Show that you know, so that we know you know. Talking about dyads and relations, I noticed a theme of maybe not mentioning the affect power and reciprocity in a relationship and how that changed. A lot of what this paper was the change because of a certain event, and how it changed and how that change influenced your development positively, negatively. And again, continuing with reading over your papers, organizing your thoughts. Some people didn't put in paragraphs. They kept it as all one big section. And making sure that you're using affect effect correctly. Another something that I noticed that there was a theme was the term apart, that would be separate from, and as one word, and a space part being a part of, a component of, and that was something that I saw a lot of people missing. And just to be aware of that's apparently something that comes up a lot in your language and how you choose to discuss something, so making sure that you check that out. Other than that, I feel like everybody had a pretty good grasp on how different experiences were supported by Bronfenbrenner's hypotheses, and I think that everybody did a really good job at being able to see the whole picture of an experience and breaking it down. If you have any questions about anything, feel free to email me, visit my office hours, I'm here for you. If you want me to read over papers in the future before you hand them in, I'm definitely available for that if you want to talk about it. Any questions or anything for me right now? Okay.
Thank you, Talia. Okay. Lack of sleep. Okay, so as Talia said, there were about 10 papers in nicely alphabetical order sitting on her desk. And when will they be in the office? Tomorrow morning. Okay, so if you come by C-150 tomorrow, they'll be available. And she apologizes for that. Okay, retakes on the eco exams. First one is tomorrow, 11 o'clock in Living Learning. And then one on Friday here, same time as class would be if we had class on Friday. And the third one on Monday after class. So take your pick if you need them. And if you can't schedule, if you can't be at any of those because of other commitments, then email either one of us and suggest times when you can be available next week, and we'll set an individual time with you. All right. Again, format and content are the same. The order of things is different. The the story to interpret will be different. It'll be one you haven't seen. And the questions will be similar for that. Okay? Any questions about eco exam retakes? Okay. I've had several people tell me that they would really like to get started on assignment 5, which is due April 18th, which must be about 4 weeks from today. Long time. But I applaud and encourage getting started on it, thinking about it, because if you get it started now and think about it, while we're going through readings and lectures on parenting particularly, which we're not to yet, but we will get to, then you can read that literature and participate in the lecture thinking about how you're going to approach the essay. And as Talia just offered for this one, if you do have a draft at some point that you would like us to look at, we're willing to do that if you give them to us by April 14th, I think we said, 13th or 14th. We need time to get it back to you so that you can use whatever comments we make on it. So we are willing to do that, and that's another reason for getting it started before the 17th of April. What are we looking for? You need to think about this and get started thinking before you write. So I've defined a preparation phase for this one, and the question is, if you accepted and conscientiously applied Bronfenbrenner's propositions and hypotheses, how would you raise children? If you were trying to do it in a developmentally appropriate way, how would you do it? Remembering that development is defined by Bronfenbrenner as the construction of a more valid and differentiated view of the world. How would you help your children get that? Or any children? You don't have to have your own to do this exercise. You can think about what happens if you inherit children at some point, or you know, find them on your doorstep and are suddenly responsible for them, which does happen. And development includes acquiring the skills and the motivation to participate in your ecosystem and to maintain it and ideally to make it better. So if you're thinking about facilitating children's development, how are you going to do that? Using the propositions and hypotheses. So what would you do? Think this through. How would you relate to them? What would you do to create and maintain a developmentally facilitating microsystem for the children you were raising, assuming you were going to be in a home kind of setting? You can choose to do it in an institutional setting if you want, or in a group or a commune, whatever you'd like, if you think that might be better, or if that's what you intend to do. What would you do to make their mesosystem as supportive of their development as possible? Those are focusing questions. And think through the whole ecosystem construct as Bronfenbrenner describes it, and think about how you would apply it to raising children. Then, after you've thought about that for a couple of weeks, tell other people what to do. Or define a set of rules for yourself to post on the refrigerator and use to guide you in raising those children. So boil it down to 6 rules and draw on your understanding of the role of the family setting and its context in children's development. So there we are. We're creating a family. We've got at least me and children, and we're in some kind of setting. How are we going to do this? And explain each rule and support it by explaining how it reflects or operationalizes, if you're scientific, Bronfenbrenner's scheme. So what would be 6 guidelines or rules that you would want to follow that, if you did, would lead you to raising children well. You need to be specific and clear and support your rules and make them as well supported as possible and give an example, perhaps. If you were going to follow this rule, what would that really mean in real life? Not a whole bunch of examples, but perhaps one. Okay? And keep it brief. Keep it concise. We assume that it will be clear, organized, literate. You will follow all of Larry's pet peeves, affect, effect, and you'll get a part and a part straight and review all the others. And what we're going to be looking for is how well have you applied the Bronfenbrenner concepts to the notion of raising kids. You can use any of the readings that apply. You have a couple of readings by Bronfenbrenner with specific propositions. You can incorporate those if you would like. There are other things on parenting in the readings. You have the whole Galinsky book, which is about parenting. So draw on anything that you want, but in the end, bring it down to the six rules and reflect Bronfenbrenner's concepts. Think about the relations, the dyads, the activities, the microsystem pattern, mesosystem connections, all of those things. The macrosystem. Tiffany. The question is whether you need to cite readings. If you use them, yes. If an idea comes from someplace, if you've really pulled it, even though if you don't quote it, you should cite it. Say, tell us where you got the idea. For supporting with Bronfenbrenner's concepts, it's sufficient to say Hype 13 or Hype 34. Hypothesis. You don't need to go into great detail at this point. Yes?
Does it matter
Does it matter how it's formatted? Do we want rule 1, rule 2, rule 3? Yes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You can provide an introductory statement if you want. You can provide a concluding statement if you want. They're not required. We should be able to see that there are six rules that are separate from each other and not have to count them or look for them. So you should label them. So rule 1, rule 2, rule 3, rule 4, rule 5, rule 6. But it should be presented. You can present the rule, but then provide your support and rationale and any example you might give for each one in a paragraph format. You know, it can be one paragraph or two or three for each rule, depending on how detailed you want to get. Okay? So the format is very straightforward and very simple. Other questions? Let me give you one other guideline. Yes, this is an opportunity to think about the wonderful job that your parents did. And the rules that they had. And you may steal and plagiarize from them all you want. But make it consistent with Bronfenbrenner. If your parents were intuitively Bronfenbrennerian, that's great. If you want to state your rule and then talk about your parents' example of that, that's fine. But there is one danger and one of Larry's really little pet peeves. This one's really petty. But there is one real danger in talking about what your parents did and how wonderful you are as a result of that. And that danger is that you will lose Bronfenbrenner. So in the past, we've used this exercise for several years. It's lots of fun to read. But in the past, people have gone on and on about what their parents did that was wonderful and failed to explain using Bronfenbrenner why what their parents did was wonderful and consistent with Bronfenbrenner. So don't lose the Bronfenbrenner in talking about wonderful examples that you have experienced. Make sure they're consistent with Bronfenbrenner. The little bitty pet peeve, I cannot tell you, because I have failed to count how many times people have ended this essay and others, but particularly this essay, with, so my parents did a wonderful job, and because of them, or what they did, or the rules that they used, I am the person, they made me the person I am today. That phrase, the person I am today, made me the person I am today, as a concluding statement, it gets funny the 30th time you read it. And yeah, your parents probably helped make you the way you are, but let's not give them all the credit. And let's not assume that you're perfect yet. But anyway, it's a minor little pet peeve, but just think about it when you start to write, this experience made me the person I am today. Just know that you can write it, it's okay. Just know that I'll be chuckling when you write it. Now, you know what's going to happen, Talia? Somebody's going to title the person I am today. All right. Okay, don't worry about my pet peeves. Any questions about the exercise? And this is a biggie. This is 40 points, potentially. So, if you're feeling behind on points, will we have a distribution now that these are done next week that I can actually put up? Good. Thank you. Good. So if you're feeling a little bit behind, this is an opportunity to gather up some points to bring you up where you'd rather be. But you couldn't see that it was 40 points because I didn't have it far enough up. There we go. Due April 18th. Finish your taxes, mail them off, finish this, turn it in. Oh, let's see, where was I? I left you on Monday with the question, is it a good idea to have lots of relations, lots of dyadic relationships, romantic involvements during adolescence and beyond? Is experience and practice good for you? Okay. So remember that was the question. Because one could suggest from Bronfenbrenner, consistently with Bronfenbrenner, that if he says being in lots of different settings is good for you, being in lots of different activities is good for you, playing lots of different roles and interacting with people who play different roles is good for you, then why not have lots of different romantic relationships? Why wouldn't that be good for you? Well, what do you think I would answer? He's not going to answer. He died. But what do you think? Are people who've had lots of relationships the kinds of partner you want to have? Do they have more skills? Are they more practiced? Are they better partners than somebody who's only had one or two? Okay, so if you only have one, then one at a time, I assume you mean, and you only have one, then you have the opportunity to make that one more complex, increase the positive affect, make the joint activities more complex and varied, and that's likely to be good, and turn it into a really nice dyad. Okay. As opposed to having short ones that don't get to develop. So you don't get to the more sophisticated, complex level of dyadic relationship that you would want to have for a long-term relationship. Okay. Is that distinction clear? How many of you would really like to stay in that state that you're in the first month of a new relationship? All the adrenaline and all the mystery and all the newness and all the excitement. Right? You want to stay with that? Some of us do. That's the fun part. When you get beyond a month, you start, you know, learning about all the warts and the flaws, and then the relationship gets harder. So maybe you don't want a long one. Maybe you want a whole bunch of month-long relationships. Okay, so the observation is that maybe that first one, the one that you're in, isn't going to develop into a really satisfying and rich dyadic relationship. And in the process of ending that one and moving on to another one, maybe you'll learn something about what you need to have, what you don't want, what you can't put up with, what you should do in a relationship when it breaks up because it's your fault, you didn't do very well in it. So maybe you need, if your relationships are not developing well, maybe you need a variety of them, or from a variety of them you will learn what works and what doesn't. Okay? And some of us have had that experience, and I would argue that you do learn, should learn, have the opportunity to learn in a relationship that isn't working. You have the opportunity to learn why, and then go on to a relationship that has more potential and avoid the same mistake. Okay. Some of us make the same mistake over and over again, right? You see your friends do that, right? They get into a bad relationship, it ends, they get into the same kind of relationship and behave the same way, and they're going to do that over and over again. Okay, so maybe it depends on how good they are, and maybe for some of us it takes a number of relationships to figure out how to have one that actually works and how to attract and maintain a relationship with a partner who has actual potential to be a good partner for us. Other thoughts about the variety versus the longevity issue? How do you apply it in your own lives? When you meet somebody, do you want to know how many relationships they've had? Do you ask? Is that part of the conversation? So, how many significant relationships have you had? How long did they last? What was wrong with them? What did you learn from them? How is this one going to be better? What do you expect of me? Do you do that in your, when you're meeting somebody? Sure. And when do you bail? When somebody says, oh, 30 or 40, you know, they last a month. And they always end because I just can't find a woman who's worth it. All women have problems. That's when you bail, right? You don't go any farther in that relationship. Okay. So what does the literature say? And it's a fascinating area to look at because there isn't much literature. If you look at the literature on romantic relationships during adolescence and into young adulthood, there are very few research studies. Very few people have actually tried to look at them. And recently, a couple or three people have begun to look at the development of romantic relationships over time in adolescence and beyond, and what people learn from them, how they influence development. And one of the people who's done that really well is a guy named Andy Collins, at the University of Minnesota. And you know what happens when you get to be famous enough and respected enough as a researcher, you can go off and study something that other people don't want to study because you're not going to blow your whole reputation. And Andy's been researching adolescent development for years, and he's very highly respected. And he began to really be frustrated by the fact that there wasn't much literature to talk about adolescent romantic relationships. So he began a study a number of years ago in which he recruited 13, 14-year-olds in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area to start with. It's expanded a little bit. But what he did was say, I want to talk to you about your boyfriends and girlfriends and dating every once in a while until you grow up. So I'd like you, if possible, to commit. And he had parental permission to ask this, and then the kids committed to being interviewed every few months about their romantic relationships. And some of them said, well, there's nothing to talk about, but you could talk about what they would like and how they intend to pursue developing partnerships through adolescence. And some of them had already started dating. So he began to study the relationships that they were in, and whenever possible, he would recruit their partners into the study. So he would interview his primary subjects, and then he would interview their partners if they were willing to do that. And if they were willing, he would interview them separately and jointly, so he could get some information about how this relationship worked for the two people. And then he would follow it, and a lot of them ended, and he would try to keep the former partners in the study and follow each of them. So you can see that this is kind of like a mushroom. You start with 30 or 40 subjects, and then over time you're going to recruit their partners, and then you're going to recruit their partners' partners and the next partners, and it's going to get big after a while, which is what has happened. So he has a very rich data set, and for his primary subjects he has 10 or more years of data on their relationships. And it's fascinating. Nobody else has ever done this. So it's a really interesting data set to look at what's going on in adolescent development. I want to just talk about one part of it. He asked the question of his data, what happens that's different for the people who don't date through adolescence compared to people who have one relationship that lasts a long time, or a couple with a long time in between, and then people who have much more experience across adolescence. And he had all of those patterns in the study. And what he found was that there was that romantic relationships have a clear impact on adolescent development, on moral development, on interpersonal skills, on attitudes, on social attitudes. There's a tremendous amount of impact that comes from those romantic peer relationships. But what interested him as he dug into the data was that the people who had the most experience, measured by the amount of time that they spent in relationships as a ratio to the number of relationships, which separates the people who are in a relationship for 3 or 4 years but just have one. What about people who are in a relationship almost all the time but over 3 or 4 years have 8 or 10 relationships? He measured the quality of those relationships by several measures. And it's interesting that if you look at the amount of time that people spend in those multiple relationships, over time, what happens is the quality steadily declines. Fascinating. When he first presented that data, those data, to a group of us, he said, this is the thing I can't explain. I don't know why. They have the experience. They have the opportunity. These are not dumb kids. These are not dumb kids. These are smart kids. They have the opportunity to learn about relationships. But the ones who have the most relationships and spend the most time in relationships are having the worst relationships, and there's a steady decline across high school and into post-high school. Many of these kids are in college and beyond. What's going on? So a group of us sat down over lunch with him and said, you know, well, let's play around with ideas, because he was looking for a way to interpret it and then follow it up. And what emerged from the group may be obvious once you think about it. If you look at the variables that are important, this pattern is for people, if you think about time, they end one relationship and immediately go into another one. And occasionally they're the people who overlap them. These are the people who leave one relationship for another. And when you do that, you're spending a lot of time in relationships, you're having a lot of relationship experience, and you're having a bad time. The different pattern is to have relationships, period of time, between relationships, the amount of time between relationships turns out to be the predictor of quality. In this second pattern, the quality of the relationships goes up. Those people are actually learning something. Those people are learning something. And what the group of us propose, and Andy's looking at it now, he's making sure that he's interviewing people between relationships, and he's looking at their thinking about the relationships that have ended. And what he's finding is that this period, which in agriculture we would call the fallow period, you're not in a relationship then, that period is crucial for psychological development. What's happening during that period is two things. These kids, you know, many of whom are your age and older, these kids are using a period of time after a relationship ends to process what happened and to put it into perspective. That's one of the things that's happening. They are thinking about what happened, and they are figuring out how they might do it differently. Second thing that's happening that seems to be really crucial is that they are using that period to re-engage with their ecosystem. They're engaged in new activities. They're going back to old friendships. They're spending time with their friends. They're restoring themselves, and they're developing their view of the world and their skills. And what we've suggested is that this period may be so important because during the relationships, some people are ignoring their ecosystem. You've seen it. Somebody gets in that first month of the relationship, they're totally wrapped up in the partner, and they neglect their friends, they neglect activities that they have enjoyed, they stop reading books or going to movies or whatever it is, and they are wrapped up in just developing the one skill of trying to be in this relationship and whatever goes on with that and dealing with it, and they are not engaging in their ecosystem in a way that is healthy and facilitating of their overall development. And that may be important to take into the next relationship. What you get during the fallow period is better understanding of relationships by doing the postmortem on the one that's over. And then you get a period of developing outside a relationship with your friends, with your family, with your activities. You get to be a whole person again and maybe develop more, and you take that more mature person into the next relationship, so you actually have something to offer that was better than what you offered in the previous relationship. Does that make sense? You're developing between the relationships. Not necessarily relationship skills, but interests and activities and a view of the world to take into that next relationship. These kids who have the constant relationships going on are missing development in their ecosystem, and particularly as the relationship quality goes down, the dyad is not participating in the ecosystem, which is one of the measures of quality. If people don't have activities outside the couple, they're not engaging in the ecosystem, they're not meeting other couples, they're not doing things together, they're not creating joint activities, they're not increasing their complexity, the quality of the relationship is going down. And these kids across adolescence and youth are spending more and more time in relationships which are more and more isolating and more conflict-filled. They're not developing the conflict resolution skills. And one of the measures that traces this is relationship satisfaction. These people are actually less satisfied in their relationships. So it's a bummer all the way around. So the prescription is, don't leave one relationship for another in the first place. Leave a relationship because it's not working, and then take some time to figure out why. And develop yourself as a person, get more comfortable with who you are as an individual before you offer that individual to a new person and get into a new relationship. I'm sorry?
What about
the long-term relationships with the same people, if they continue, have a variety of paths in Andy's experience, in his data. Some of those long-term relationships are the ones that where people are going to celebrate their 70th wedding anniversary. They met in 8th grade. They start dating in 9th grade. They never date anybody else. They get married when they're 19, and they are happily with each other the rest of their lives. Then you can think about what it is they're doing. They're creating a quality relationship. They're engaged in their environment. They're learning the skills together. They're growing up together. And you know, that's sort of what we'd all like to have. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we wouldn't all like to have that. Most of us don't have a chance. Not going to get there. My second wife and I are coming up on our 50th wedding anniversary. It's easy to do. Figure that. How old am I? We're going to have a 50th wedding anniversary in a couple of years, 3 years. Where are we? 46 years, I think. We're at 48. How do you do that? Well, her first marriage was 21 years, and my first marriage was 21 years. That's 42. We've been married 6 years. That's 48, right? So we get to 50. We deserve it. Right? Okay. But the only way you can get there in a single marriage is to get there early and stay for a long time. My mother's cousin, whom I interviewed in November, the 96-year-old, lost his wife when he was 91. And they had been married for 72 years. They married when he was 19 and she was 18. And they just had that incredibly wonderful relationship. And I asked him how. He said, in the first place, we never went to bed, never went to sleep mad at each other. We always talked it out. Second was, she was my best buddy. We did things together. She loved to travel. I loved to travel. We traveled all over the world. She liked to camp. She liked trailering. You know, we found the same things funny. Religious beliefs were the same. We both were wrapped up in our kids. Said we just, that was the way it happened. And I'm jealous. You know? Okay. No, he did it. Another pattern for those long-term relationships is that they last for a long time, and then they start to get gradually less satisfying. And that happens regularly. People have the one relationship through high school, they bring it to college, and the dissatisfaction level increases, and satisfaction with the relationship starts to decrease, and they eventually break up. And often, the comment that I hear is, and we should have broken up before, I wish we hadn't tried to keep it together long after it was dead. So what they do is they commit to the relationship and they're afraid to end it for, you know, quite legitimate reasons. So the long-term relationships have a variety of satisfaction levels, and if they're highly satisfying, they persist. If the satisfaction decreases for whatever reason, then they eventually end. The people who have this pattern of generally increasing satisfaction in relationships and have multiple relationships clearly have the periods of developing on their own between. The people who have the most serious decline in satisfaction are the ones who aren't taking time between. And you can think about people you know who have that kind of pattern. Can they be by themselves? Do they define themselves as partner? You got to have a boyfriend, you got to have a girlfriend, or you're one of those people who is so attractive to other people, and you're in an environment that has so many people who are looking for you, that you never have an opportunity to be on your own. No. Because you turn around and somebody's hitting on you, and so there you go again. I don't know what that would be like, but I'm sure some of you do. I've had lots of opportunity to engage the monkish part of my personality. Monk, you know, like monk, not monkey, monk-ish part. I might have a monkey-ish part, but okay. Okay, so that answers that question, I think. What it does is put the relationships into the context of what are you learning in them and what are you learning outside of them, and what is the relationship doing to engage you in the rest of your bigger ecosystem. Is the relationship part of your ecosystem and encourages you to be engaged in all kinds of other activities that can continue to help you develop? Or is it isolating you from engagement in the world? And that's a significant variable for assessing a relationship. Is this person during this period of the relationship completely wrapped up in that relationship and not doing anything else, and that's not good? Or is this person having either periods of time to be on his or her own in the ecosystem and explore and grow, or is the relationship encouraging that? Does your partner, for example, encourage you to maintain your friendships and explore other things that aren't within the couple? What we call a relatively open relationship. A developmental dyad in a relationship would encourage you to explore the world and would trust you to do that and would be interested in the things that you do outside the relationship and would encourage that, would support it. And in fact, that begins to define a good marriage. as opposed to one that is stifling. The stifling one keeps you from engaging in the larger ecosystem. Okay. I'm deciding which way to go. I'm going this way. We talked about visiting each other's settings as part of dating. And I wanted to expand on that, the notion of settings and what role settings play in the dyadic relationship. And typically what happens is that you occasionally visit each other's settings, and then you occasionally share them, like a weekend or hotel room for spring break, or in my brother's case, sharing a sleeping bag on a camping trip in Colorado when he was in college. He ended up marrying the person whose sleeping bag he shared. He lost his. Climbing up a cliff, his sleeping bag came off the back of his pack and went down, and there was no way he was going to get it, so he ended up sharing a sleeping bag. I guess that's sharing a setting, right? So they shared a sleeping bag, and then they got married. All right, I'm not going any farther with that one. And then occasionally some of you have had the experience of deciding that you're going to live together, right? How many of you have cohabited, living in sin, as your grandparents will say, and it's the most wonderful experience you've ever had in your life, and it was really easy? Yeah. Okay. How many of you, the rest of you haven't? Okay. And they had good experiences, so they're not going to believe anything I am about to say. But I'll put it out there anyway. How many of you have friends or relatives who have cohabited and had problems? Yeah, what kinds of problems do they have? What happens when they start cohabiting? Okay, so you find out things about the other person that you might not like, such as
the way that they keep their house, or if they're obsessive about something, they have to.
The way they keep house, the way they keep their possessions, what they do with their dirty laundry, whether they squeeze the toothpaste tube in the middle, whether they lose the cap to the toothpaste tube, whether they leave hair in the sink, whether they know how to clean a bathtub, whether they leave the toilet lid up, whether they, this is a significant one, do they flush in the middle of the night after they pee or not, or do they, for some reason that's a significant difference among people. Do they pee in the shower or not? It's interesting to do couples work and find out what drives them apart, or at least what breaks the camel's back. Unequal division of household labor, yes. Probably the biggest one. Guys really get discouraged when they shack up with somebody and they expect to be equal partners and the woman doesn't do any of the household work. Now, this is a real problem. It's a very common one. Right? No. Different perceptions of what household work needs to be done. Different views of the world. Different, not wrong, just different views of how dirty something needs to get before it needs to be clean. And one of the reasons, of course, that women end up doing more of the household chores is that they always get to it before the guy does. They often get to it before the guy does because it offends them sooner. The guy will eventually do it in order to get the damage deposit back when he moves out of the apartment. Maybe. if he can't get his mother to come. And okay, we're not being serious, folks. We're not being serious about cohabitation problems. Other problems that people run into? The cohabiting is fine, and they're great roommates, but the relationship, the romantic part of the relationship, fades. You're talking about marriage. No, you're talking about cohabiting. Why does the romantic part fade when you're sharing a bathroom all the time? Because romantic relationships fade, period. Whether you're living together or not. And the more time you spend together, the more valid your view of the other person gets, and the more realistic you are about the other person, the less likely you are to be romantic with them, unless you really work at it. Long-term happy relationships involve people who have a realistic view of each other and balance that with an idealized view. Sometimes you listen to these people who have been married for 40 or 50 years talk about why they've been so happy and why they've stayed together, and you wonder if they're talking about a real human being. Because sometimes they romanticize and idealize the other person so much, you're wondering, wow. And you think they're fooling themselves, they're delusional. And they probably are, but they're happily married. So maybe a long-term happy marriage involves a little bit of delusion about the other person, or at least willingness to frame it in a positive and idealized way. So there you are, stuck in the cohabiting relationship with a good roommate, and you'd like to go date somebody else, but you're committed to each other, and that's a problem. Except that some people do go out and start dating other people. They just don't tell you about it. Right? They don't tell their partners, so they're living with one and dating the other one, and this is eventually going to get them in hot water. Yep. People for whom the romance fades often stay as roommates because they can't afford in Burlington to live anyplace else. They can't find another place. And occasionally couples do end the romantic relationship and decide, you know, okay, we tried this, it doesn't work, but we need to stay together. And they'll figure out how to do that until the end of the lease period or until graduation or whatever else comes up. Okay. But cohabitation is an ecological transition, okay? Especially if you are both moving into new space together. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's like playing house. You anticipate it. You get to go apartment hunting. This is a wonderful joint activity, especially if you have money and can do it. In Burlington, it's a problem for, as many of you know. But anyway, you go out and you do the apartment hunting, and then you plan to move in together, and then you do. So you're strengthening the couple relationship by engaging in this joint activity. You are making a huge commitment to each other. One of the difficulties in cohabiting relationships often is that people have not talked about the commitment. They assume the commitment. So one of the things that happens is that each person has brought his or her assumptions, his or her view of the world, into the cohabiting situation, and they have never really talked about the assumptions that they have made, and then they bump their heads on the fact that their assumptions are different. And 3 or 4 or 5 months into it, they've discovered that the assumptions are different, and then they have to pull out their conflict resolution skills to figure out that they are in a situation where they are tied to the lease, they are financially dependent on each other, and they don't share the same view of what they're doing. So there's a whole set of commitments and agreements that cohabiting couples who want to be successful at cohabiting will explore and make. And these fall in the same category as marriage agreements. People typically refuse to make marriage contracts. They don't want to talk about the important stuff because that would take all of the romance out of it. So they don't. And then they discover they have very different views of the world because they've never talked about it. Well, I love him, therefore we don't need to talk about it. Well, we love each other. It'll all work out. Gag me. That's an invalid view of the world. Love does not impart or imply skill or a shared view of the world or the ability to create a shared view of the world. Love won't do that. And in fact, love will often keep people from doing that because they don't want to threaten the love. If we talk about the important things, like finances, birth control, how many children we want to have, who does the toilet cleaning, if we talk about those things, it means we don't love each other enough. Could be. But if you don't talk about them, you won't love each other enough. People also will not do my version of marriage agreements, which is to write your divorce agreement before you get married. Why would one want to do that? You do that because, no, you're not going to get divorced. No. Nobody wants to get divorced. Nobody expects to get divorced when they get married. So that would be the ideal time to agree on how you would behave if you divorced. Right? Because you love each other, it's not going to happen. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about what's going to happen if we divorce. And just write our agreement and tuck it in the drawer. And then we don't have to worry about it. If we ever divorce, there it is. We did it when we loved each other. Now we don't, but we don't have to go through the fight. Here it is. We just agree to it. If they did that, the divorce would be much less harmful to the partners and to the children because they would know how they were going to treat each other. They would have agreed while they loved each other. And then they can just say, okay, here it is. Okay. But people don't expect a divorce, and they figure talking about it. We can engage in this wonderful, wonderful superstitious behavior. B.F. Skinner's birthday was yesterday, by the way. He was 103. I mean, he would have been. Superstitious behavior. We all engage in superstitious behavior. The fun part for me as a family systems person is that much of the most important superstitious behavior we engage in is around relationships. We do all kinds of things like, say, well, we shouldn't talk about money because if we do, it means we don't love each other enough. And people who love each other don't talk about money. Not talking about money when you love each other is pretty much guaranteed to make you love each other less when you run into financial problems, which are the most common problems in marital conflict. It's not sex, it's money. And how you handle it and how you think of it. The biggest problem in divorce is money. Not kids, it's money. So if you don't talk about the money along the way because you don't like money and it's not consistent with romance, if you don't talk about it, it will come up and bite you in the ass at some point. Okay. And then you will figure out that you should have talked about it because you have very different views. So, write your cohabiting agreement before you decide to move in together or as you are. Who is going to clean the toilets? Who is responsible for paying the bills? And how are each of you contributing? There are many ways to contribute to household finances. None of them is the perfect one, but you need to have an agreement. If he makes five times as much money as she does, should they pay equal amounts toward the living expenses? Well, Maybe, maybe not. Is equity based on paying equal amounts, or is it based on paying equal proportions? Okay. If his income is five times greater, then perhaps he should be paying 5/6 of the household expenses. Okay. Think about it. And talk about it and agree. Same with dating. Who pays for dinner? You know, do you do the traditional thing of, well, it's, you know, it's the guy who pays, right? You're all feminists. You all believe in equity and equality between the sexes. So you go Dutch every time, right? Of course you do. Or whoever asks the other out is responsible for paying. At some point, you have to talk about that. Because some of us end up in a situation where we didn't talk about it, very different assumptions, and we get to feel used. We get to feel like this is unfair. And when we start to feel that we're being treated unfairly, financially, the romance is all gone. Just gone. So you have to bring it up, you have to talk about it, and ideally you talk about it in advance. If you acquire possessions together, whose are they? Whose are they? May not be important if one of you or both of you are assuming that cohabiting is a step toward marriage. That's an important assumption to know. Do you assume that cohabiting is the step toward marriage? It's interesting how many people go into cohabiting situations with one of them believing that and the other one not. And they go into it and then a year or two later they're still cohabiting and the one starts to feel his or her assumptions are not being met, so we need to be moving this on. When's the ring coming? And the other one is rather flabbergasted when that issue finally hits the fan in the middle of a fight, which is about something else, but is really fueled by the fact that I'm disappointed because we've been living together 2 years now, and the idea of marriage, every time I bring it up, you laugh it off. You know, but I thought if we lived together, we were on the way to marriage, but you obviously don't share that. No, why didn't you talk about it before you moved in together? So when you do stop cohabiting, who gets the stereo? Who gets to keep the apartment when you break up? In Burlington, this is not an insignificant issue. In New York City, with rent control, it is not an insignificant issue, because if your name is on the lease and you stay on the lease, the rent is controlled, or used to be. I don't know if it's still the same way in New York City. But if the person whose name wasn't on the lease at first gets it, it's a new lease, and the rent is likely to quadruple because it's not controlled when it turns over. This is not an insignificant issue if you have a nice apartment in New York City that's actually affordable. And they are there, but they are there because of rent control. What do you do when you get pregnant and you're cohabiting? Well, you talk about that in any romantic relationship, right? Contraception is not 102% sure. So any sexual relationship has the potential to result in pregnancy. What's the agreement? What are you going to do in that case? Cohabiting couples are more likely to become pregnant than couples who don't live together. I don't know why. I have some thoughts. You probably do too. And one of those thoughts has to do with whose responsibility contraception is and who's assuming that cohabitation is the next step toward marriage. And if that assumption is not being met and you're the one responsible for contraception, you can do that next step, which more than half of brides in the United States currently take. Having a child is the most common motivator to move from cohabitation to marriage, to take that step. People wait until they get pregnant to get married. So if you know that, and this one doesn't look like it's moving toward marriage fast enough, there you go. All right, so let's get pregnant, and that will force the issue. Yes, it will force the issue, that, and that's a pun, forcing the issue. The issue is the child. Pregnancy has an issue, too. And there you are. Breaking up, or not, because you've figured out, some of you have figured out that paying child support for 18 years without benefit of marriage, which is what you're going to do, you can pay for child support for 18 years, is actually more expensive than going ahead with the marriage and then divorcing and paying child support. The interesting twist in the child support laws is based on whose income is incorporated into child support. And marital divorce child support is calculated differently than non-married couple not living together child support. So it's actually cheaper to get married and then divorced in that situation. So anyway, it gets wonderfully complicated. Okay, you go into the cohabiting situation. You are creating a microsystem. This is a completely unprecedented, unique, never-before-done microsystem because the two of you have never lived together. So what happens is each person brings his or her relationship history and microsystem of home experience and cohabiting experiences into this new setting. And there's this wonderful thing that happens, which is that couples who have dated to the point where cohabitation seems like a good idea have often had what we would call an egalitarian or equal and equitable relationship that is not highly gendered, because they are both employed, they're both out there in the world, they both do important things, and they're not gendered. I mean, clearly, you know, they're two people, and if it's a heterosexual couple, they're male and female, but microsystems are gendered. The cohabiting microsystem creates pressure for the traditional gendered roles. When he is living in his own space and she is living in her own space, they have equal obligation and responsibility to maintain their space, independent of each other. When they start sharing a space and create a microsystem, they will, this is a guarantee, if they do not discuss it at the beginning and fight it every day together, they will create a traditional division of labor and traditional male-female roles. Because that's what they grew up with. That's what the macro system says we all should do. And even the best of us who have all the delusion of the intention of being equal partners will come home and wonder what's for dinner, rather than having engaged in the conversation as an equal before in planning what's for dinner. And the one of us who has more culinary skills and more interest in nutrition and better food intelligence will plan the dinner after she's cleaned the bathroom. And he will watch football. This is a gross generalization and stereotype. And it is one of the biggest problems when a couple, male-female, create a microsystem together. If they don't talk about it, there will be tremendous pressure for the traditional roles. And that will eventually lead to exactly the conflict the traditional male-female roles in our society lead to in married couples, which is conflict, disappointment, dissatisfaction, divorce, all of those things that you probably don't want. You're creating roles, you're creating a pattern of relationships, and you're creating a set of activities that are connected with housekeeping, which neither of you may have had much to do with before. There you are. You've got to do them. So you can either start by agreeing on a specific set of activities and roles and a way of dividing them, or you can stumble into whatever conflicts are going to arise. But the problem is you're creating a unique and unprecedented microsystem, and you either do it deliberately, making it the way you want it, which requires conversation and agreement, discussion as a molar activity, or you fall into whatever bad habits and patterns you have experienced growing up and in your previous relationships. Earlier, we had the comment that you learn things about the other person that drive you nuts. Daily rhythms. Fascinating. People have different biorhythms. They have different diurnal rhythms. And you find that one of you never goes to sleep before midnight, and the other one never stays awake past 10. And one of you gets up at 5 and does housework, and the other one sleeps till noon. This will be a conflict, because those rhythms don't work together very well. You've experienced it with roommates. You can experience it in the couple relationship. Of all the maintenance, chores, responsibilities, food, who chooses furnishings, who arranges them? There's a wonderful phenomenon. This is one of Larry's observations of the world, which is that for some reason women believe that they get to decorate. Women believe that they know how to arrange furniture in a room appropriately and where to hang the pictures, and they will do that without consulting. They will ask you to pound the nail in and move it, but can you do it collaboratively? Can you take the furniture that both of you brought from Salvation Army histories, can you put them in the same space and arrange them in a way that works? Can you rearrange them in a way that works? And in my experience, a lot of us put the furniture down where it seems to fit and then get used to it, walk around it, and we never move it. Because if we moved it, we'd have to dust under it. And others of us are never quite happy, so we rearrange the furniture over and over and over again and replace it and do that sort of thing. It's okay if you agree on what you're doing, but one of the things that leads to that traditional male-female division of labor and the traditional roles is that one of you is likely to get very interested in color and decor and curtains and color coordination and all that stuff, and the other one may have much less interest in it. And it's a very interesting couple where both, particularly if they're both male and female, each different gender, where they both have it and they both begin to do the battle about who gets to do these things. I've seen a couple of couples where one of them rearranges the furniture whenever the other one is gone, and one of them paints the bathroom whenever the other one is gone, and they've got dueling decoratorships going on. They're fun. Finances. And finally, the mesosystem connections. What happens to people from the other settings? And this comes down to things like, who is welcome in the apartment when? And who gets a key? Have you co-partnered, have you cohabited with somebody who believes that his father should of course have a key to your apartment because he might want to come in and fix stuff, right? Or he may need a place to crash, so he has a key. Have you cohabited with somebody who believes that nobody in the entire universe should have a key to the apartment? in the one case, you get your refrigerator cleaned, cabinets stocked, food brought in by the other person's family, and that's an invasion of your privacy. So discussions about how you connect to other mesosystem settings are an important part of the cohabiting process, and I'll see you on Monday.